Growing businesses and finance professionals, you need Bill Spend and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software. It's powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card, which helps growing companies scale with credit lines of $500 to $15 million, automated expense reports, and as many virtual cards as you need. For a limited time, get $500 when you get started with Bill Spend and Expense. Request a demo at bill.com/get500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine and available on all podcasting platforms. Ever since the Israeli onslaught in Gaza started after the Hamas attack of October 7th, many of us have wondered, what exactly is Joe Biden doing? Why is he, like, you know, potentially risking his presidency on behalf of a government, that of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, that openly despises Biden and has every interest in undermining Biden's presidency and reelecting Donald Trump for his second term? This question is also driven by the unpopularity of what Israel is doing in the United States, particularly among key demographics within the Democratic Party coalition. And because of this question, there's been, like, you know, like a real inspection of the historical record of Joe Biden to, like, ask, where does this president come from in terms of thinking about the Middle East? And there have been a number of interesting pieces about this, which we'll get to in a second. But for today's episode, I want to talk about and introduce David Kleon, a frequent guest of the program, frequent writer for The Nation, The New Republic, and Jewish Currents, and also the author of, I think, one of the best and most interesting pieces about Biden and his relationship with Israel, Palestine, and the whole issue of Zionism. This is David Kleon and his essay, The Lifelong Incoherence of Biden's Israel Strategy, has just been published by The Nation. So first of all, welcome, David, and perhaps we can start by, you know, rehearsing the arguments of your piece.
Great to be back, as always. So this piece, it kind of came about in an unexpected way, actually. It was commissioned with not a very, like, clear focus. Basically, like, a few weeks after October 7th and after I had written this piece for N plus one about, you know, kind of drawing parallels between the post October 7th and 9/11, The Drift, which is another left-wing small magazine, reached out to me. I've written for them before, and they wanted to know if I wanted to do something about post October 7th. And the theme that we came up with together was basically tracing the history of Biden, but also his generation of Democrats, and trying to kind of explain why, to, like, a younger generation that, you know, might be baffled by what the U.S. was doing, like, why older Democrats were so attached to Israel. And so I got to work on that, and I kept digging, and they kept encouraging me to dig more. And for a while, my sort of operative thesis was that, you know, if you were a certain age around the time of the 1967 war, and you were a liberal and you were disenchanted with the Vietnam War and so on, like, Israel held itself up as this left-wing countercultural alternative, right? It was a, for Jews, it was a way to sort of embrace identity mm-hmm. and reject assimilation in the, at the height of the civil rights movement. As you know, American identity in general was kind of being reassessed. For liberal Jews, you know, people like Tom Friedman have written about how, you know, Israel was like heroic for them at a time when America wasn't necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I sort of like assumed that was the general drift of how Democrats thought at that time. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized, well, Joe Biden, first of all, he's not a Jew, obviously. Second of all, he's actually a little bit older than some of the lefty boomer types who did fall for Israel around then. You know, I guess he's about the same age as Bernie Sanders, who did briefly. But third of all, like, actually nothing about his trajectory seemed to really fit that narrative. Mm-hmm. A revised version of it was sort of drawing a contrast between him and other people his age. And then I started to get rid of the other people his age entirely on subsequent revisions, and it started to become much more Biden focused. And in the process, not only did he not fit the narrative I'd sort of expected, but more and more details kept coming up. If you do a deep dive just into like the Times machine, you know, the New York Times' archives, and you just start searching for like Biden in Israel over decades, because he's been in the news for over 50 years and has had some relationship with Israel for pretty much that entire time. More and more what you discover, and this is what the piece ended up being, and eventually, you know, no hard feelings at all, but eventually it wasn't going to work for the drift. I took it to the Nation. We reworked it a little more. I mean, this was, you know, this started last fall. So not only did it go through many iterations, but also the, you know, we've had time to see Biden's policy unfold mm-hmm. and the conventional wisdom around it form. So by the time the piece was in the hands of the Nation, which it wasn't for very long, the place I had kind of landed on is that Biden is incoherent on the issue of Israel-Palestine. That not only has his policy in office over the last now 8 months since October 7th been totally incoherent, but if you go back over his entire history, it's incoherent. And there's all you search in vain for a through line. There's all kinds of things that happen that I wouldn't say, you know, and I said early in the piece, I don't intend this as a defense at all. I think Biden's record is pretty indefensible. But there are things you find that don't quite fit the narrative that some other writers who I respect very much have established about Biden. You know, the basic conventional wisdom that's formed is that Biden is Israel's best friend in Washington, certainly among Democrats, that he always has been. And that he, you know, that it's zealous for him. And he's always taken the hardest possible line. Mm-hmm. And that explains why he's, you know, given them so much deference in the current war. And while he's never been a leftist or an anti-Zionist or anything like that, and you wouldn't expect him to be, it's actually striking how many like notable exceptions there are to this. Along with a lot confirming that basic narrative. For instance, he was very, very outspoken under both Carter and Reagan, at least in the early Reagan years, about settlements. He didn't just nominally oppose settlements, which were expanding under the right-wing Begin and Shamir prime ministerships. He was saying, like, you know, the American people hate this. Like we should withhold aid if we're going to do this. I mean, the things you'll hear people say now, like even Ronald Reagan was better than, you know, than Joe Biden is on things like conditioning aid to settlements. Then you go back and it's like, no, actually Joe Biden at certain points was also talking about conditioning aid for settlements. And what's baffling is then you go to like 1991, I think, under the H.W. Bush administration, and you have James Baker, Bush's Secretary of State, actually trying to condition military aid to Israel on their halting settlement expansion. And Biden is one of the leading voices trying to stop that. he actually fails in the immediate term. And this is better known. That's a story that shows up in all the accounts of why Biden's been Israel's best friend, because he basically sponsored some legislation that either failed to pass or was vetoed, I forget which, but that would have, you know, ensured that Israel keeps access to its funding in spite of the settlements. He's also reversed himself on things like whether it's okay to publicly criticize Israel or not. I mean, he was very vocally publicly criticizing Israel in the early 80s. And then by the, I think, late 80s, he's meeting with the Israeli ambassador to the United States and saying, like, you know, we don't criticize friends publicly, basically, like laying down that as a line. But then a few years later, he actually does. When Bill Clinton was pursuing the Camp David Accords in 2000, which ultimately failed, of course, but Biden was not just supporting his president, but, you know, the Democrats themselves were actually divided on nuanced issues of, you know, how basically how supportive the U.S. should be of peace initiatives, how critical it should be of Israeli intransigence. And like Joe Lieberman was heading the sort of AIPAC aligned, you know, never criticize Israel under any circumstances side. Biden was on the other side, the more dovish side. And then he continued that posture into the at least early years of the W. Bush administration. You can read more and more details about this in my piece, but the gist is like he's just gone back and forth on all of these things. I mean, over decades, you can see him saying never criticize Israel. You can see him saying like Israel is our best friend and supports our national interest. You can see him criticizing Israel, calling out settlements, saying they might have to withdraw settlements from the West Bank and, you know, for a two-state solution in a New York Times op-ed. But then, you know, you get to the Obama administration and there's an oft-repeated story, which I repeat too, about how he, you know, how Netanyahu timed a new settlement announcement to sort of humiliate Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And Biden, like, called him up basically and said, don't worry about this. Like, no one's actually mad at you. I got you. And undermined, you know, any U.S. negotiating position there. So it's like, what's the deal? And then you go to the present, you go to the last 8 months and, you know, broadly, substantively speaking, policy wise, we basically have given the Israelis everything they want. And the result is, I would say, a brutal genocidal policy, just war crimes and a world historical disaster. But at least rhetorically and in terms of how it's framed, anyone can see Biden has been all over the place. I mean, he's basically constantly saying, well, we wouldn't support it if you did this, and then they do this, and we continue to support it. You know, he'll freeze. I mean, just in the last few weeks, he announced that it was time for the war to end on, I think, May 31st. We're recording this on June 20th, 3 weeks later. And he said there was a, you know, that Israel had brought forward a ceasefire plan, which multiple Israeli officials have since denied doing. He said, you know, invading Rafah would be a permanent war and that would be a disaster. Would you believe they were already invading Rafah and have continued to invade Rafah? They've killed, we know, hundreds more, but I'm guessing more than that, Palestinians in the intervening time. You know, there's no sign of any of this stopping. And we did a weapons pause, which we've then reversed. And on the same day it was announced, I guess 2 days ago, that in the same day that the Washington Post broke the story that the White House had been leaning on more progressive Democratic lawmakers to support a new arms sale to Israel as they invaded Rafah and violated Biden's red line. Netanyahu comes out and attacks Biden and Blinken in a video for, you know, withholding weapons, which the Biden administration is now furious with him about, supposedly. So, you know, I mean, I guess the through line, I guess one cynical read could be Biden supports Israel always, but sometimes he pretends not to and like mouths not to. And I think, you know, I'm tempted to see it that way, but I actually think maybe we're giving Biden a little too much credit for having like strategy and a through line here by yeah. framing it that way. I think that he's just hapless and doesn't really understand who he's dealing with or what he's dealing with. And it has amounted to a very pro-Israel policy over decades, but I think we're giving him too much credit for coherence to suggest that that's
what he is. No, we're not dealing with like a kind of like mastermind, you know, who has this all planned out. It reminds me a little bit of, there's a classic Saturday Night Live skit during the Reagan era when Iran-Contra broke out, and it had Reagan like, you know, addressing the press as a kind of bumbling fool and then doing a lot of photo op with people like Jimmy Stewart and like seeming right. to be out of it. And then, but once everyone leaves, he's with his aides and he's like this brilliant genius who's like speaks multiple languages and is coordinating this global conspiracy. I don't think that was what happened under Reagan, and I don't think that's what happened under Biden. There is a kind of incoherence, which I think your piece brings up brilliantly.
I also want to be clear, since there's so much talk about Biden's age and, you know, has he lost a step? I mean, I think he probably has lost a step, but I am emphatically not arguing he's senile and like literally has no idea what's going on. I actually think I think he's been a blustery, you know, kind of incompetent on this issue for his entire career. I think he was like this in his 30s.
Their cognitive problems, they started when Biden was very young. Also,
as a small thing, I also caught that Biden has at least two, but possibly more than two origin stories for his fervently felt Zionism. There's the one he tells that I frankly don't find very plausible or credible, but he does tell it all the time, that when he was six, his father, you know, a mid-Atlantic Catholic, car dealer or whatever, told him, you know, that of course he has to support the newly founded State of Israel, which wasn't even like a major U.S. project at the time.
You're too polite to say it, but that's obviously
that story is a lie.
That story is a lie,
but we can at least say, or I mean, he may have convinced himself it's true over time, but through repetition, more plausibly, because more contemporaneously, and also relevant to what I think you want to talk about, is that he says Scoop Jackson taught him all this in the 70s, basically, and taught it in very similar terms of. Mm. of the Jews needed a place to go after the Holocaust, and you should go to Dachau and look at concentration camps, which Biden has sent all his children and grandchildren to do. Biden actually said upon Jackson's death, you know, a few years after that would have been, that that's where he got it from. And the fact that he said it at the time and that it was important to him because Jackson wasn't Jewish either, and he said that, I mean, Biden literally said that's like the first time I learned it. So I actually, we can't know for sure, but I'm inclined to think that the Jackson story is closer to the truth, and that Biden has retroactively made his father into Scoop Jackson.
I mean, he also has like, the father story is very similar to, like, he has another story about his father, like, you know, like being pro-gay the 50s and something like that. And actually not even pro-gay marriage equality in like the 50s or 60s, which just seems like, anyways. But I think that there's two points to make. One of which is, I want to just situate your article in this kind of conversation or dialogue that I think is going on about Biden's foreign policy, because I think that you're really reacting to or building on, but also adding nuance to like an earlier narrative that, came from a piece by Jonathan Geyer in The American Prospect, and also a piece by Noah Lennard in Mother Jones. And these are actually, I would say, both really good pieces that do kind
very
of...
Good.
Yeah,
very good. This, when Geyer's piece first came out, which was, you know, months after I had first started on this, but months before I finally published it, I was like, do I even need to do this piece anymore? Maybe he's already done it. And then I kept digging, basically.
It is this sort of narrative of, Biden, the super Zionist, which I think, like, if you talk about it, like, in terms of actual practice, not in terms of rhetoric. Like, I actually do think that that is where it all ultimately ends up landing. Like, there's always been rhetorical nuance or rhetorical incoherence or gestures towards, you know, critiques of the settlements. But, like, you know, like, where Biden ultimately, like, lands in terms of practical action, I think it's more meaningful once he's, like, you know, in the executive branch in the as a vice president and president. I do think that, you know, there's something where the fundamental orientation is towards Zionism, but with a sort of complications, which I think your piece brings out really well. And I think it's that complication, that incoherence, which explains not all the trouble that he's in, but it actually gets at the trouble. So I think we should acknowledge those pieces.
Those pieces were good, and yeah. I benefited a lot from them. And there was also a lot in we've previously talked about Alexander Ward's book, which I reviewed for The Nation. But he has a whole chapter on the Middle East, and a lot of it is actually retracing a version of this history too. And as I was reading it for that review, I also found it useful for this piece in sort of lining up like the major examples over the decades. It's not that anyone was inaccurate, and I respect all the writers involved. It's just that, like, there's always more. Had such a long career. And I mean, I should also give, you know, one of the editors at The Drift actually, in doing some fact checking, dug up one of these examples, and that, you know, helped point me in this direction too. So yeah. It's like it's like your assumptions. I mean, this isn't a case where I wanted to be contrarian for contrarianism's sake. It's more like I actually really did intuitively believe the and still to a certain extent believe it. I mean, I say in the piece it's broadly accurate that he's always been a stalwart Zionist, because it is. But I feel like the nuances and the inconsistencies do point to something specific about Biden, which is that because he's kind of all over the place on this, I think he's easy to push around,
Is
what Netanyahu has been doing to great effect.
Yeah, yeah, no, Netanyahu and possibly even some of his advisors. The incoherence, I think one way of thinking about it is through the lens of sort of Cold War liberalism, and that's why I was glad that you talked about Scoop Jackson, you know, as part of Biden's origin story. And
right, which I should say you've previously written about the Biden Scoop Jackson connection for The Nation.
And yeah, that's right.
And I acknowledge that, because that was also a very helpful connection to draw.
Yeah, and just to, like, sort of, you know, I think Scoop Jackson, the name has a certain currency among people I would describe as sickos. These sort of, like, you know, retro Cold War liberals who create things like the Scoop Jackson Society or whatever. But it's not, I don't think it's somebody that listeners under, let's say, the age of 80 are necessarily familiar with the name of Scoop Jackson. But he was a longtime politician, congressman, and senator from the state of Washington, and had a kind of position that has basically sort of disappeared except for Joe Biden, which was Cold War liberalism. He was the uber Cold War liberal. And that meant it's an interesting combination, because he was, like, super hawkish, you know, supported the Vietnam War long after everyone else had kind of abandoned it, was always, like, you know, went after the Nixon administration from the right, saying that, you know, like, why are you having detente with these people? And very strongly pro-Israel, and very closely aligned with the sort of nascent neoconservative movement. I mean, his basic staff included all the people that would go on to do so much damage under the Reagan and Bush administration, the two Bushes.
Yeah, I mean, they were, like, his Elliot disciples Abrams. In a lot of ways. Elliot Abrams, Richard Pearl, Douglas Feith,
Paul Wolfowitz.
All like worked for him when they were fresh faced, and kept, it was like a clubbiness, as sometimes happens in a prominent senator's staff, that those ties can last for decades. It's not that much of an exaggeration to say that, like, the seeds of the Iraq War and other Bush era foreign policy were actually planted in Scoop Jackson's staff in the 70s.
Yeah, but I mean, all this sort of Cold War hawkishness was combined with an actually like impressive domestic record of support of civil rights and very pro-union. I mean, with the understanding that through military Keynesianism, you know, you could get like, you know, good paying union jobs and American global hegemony, like the two things go together. That you know, he was, you know, for those of us who are more skeptical of him, would refer to him as the senator from Boeing. But he's not just Boeing, but also, you know, Boeing at that time. It's, you know, this all ended with the kind of Reagan deregulation and pushback against labor rights. But, you know, like Boeing was both an excellent manufacturer at that time of airplanes and weapon systems, and also you know,
civilian airplanes too, of course.
Yeah, civilian airplanes, yeah, which they at that time knew how to make, but also had like great union jobs and just great jobs in general. I mean, this is the height of the sort of American empire as a successful project. And so you had like, you know, like if you were like a top-notch engineer, you know, you'd want to work there. And so it kind of made sense for like someone who's like a Democrat, pro-union, pro-civil rights, to also be like uber hawkish. And the thing with that Cold War liberalism was, it ultimately proved to be an incoherent project. And already by the 70s, when those neocons were there, one saw it, you know, that this could no longer, it was hard to reconcile that project with the Democratic coalition, because, you know, like many Democrats and many Americans were against the Vietnam War, but also it's hard to reconcile liberalism and liberal pretenses of things like human rights with the sort of, you know, like ultra-hawkish program. And it's not surprising that someone like Elliott Abrams would ultimately find, you know, like a better home in the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan.
To be fair, on the other end of things, and I'm as regular listeners may know, I'm working on a book about the neocons, and Jeet is a longtime neocon head, so this is all stuff we're like enmeshed in right now. But you know, on the right too, there were or in the Republican Party, there was and still is. In fact, you could say it's resurgent. A lot of resistance to this kind of thinking too.
Yes.
I mean, James Baker, the aforementioned H.W. Bush Secretary of State, is generally seen as a realist and was very hostile to this kind of thinking. I mean, a story that, you know, real neocon heads know is that the neocons having, I mean, the basic trajectory here is that Cold War liberalism was the hegemonic doctrine, for, you know, much of the 50s and 60s, and in the, you know, Kennedy era and so on. Vietnam wrecked it by the late 60s, early 70s. The Democratic Party went left on foreign policy with, you know, the nomination of McGovern. And so people like Scoop Jackson staffers, for instance, or Norman Podhoretz or so on, you know, for much of the 70s, they considered themselves the kind of last defenders of Cold War liberalism in the context of the Democratic Party. They were trying to save the Democratic Party from, you know, McGovernism. And they were largely failing, but they even gave it a shot with Carter and failed by their own reckoning. And so they joined the Reagan administration. And those early Reagan years, and that's when they really embraced being, you know, part of the Republican firmament. And in the early Reagan years, it seemed like they were getting their way. They got Gene Kirkpatrick and Elliott Abrams and all these other people in their cohort into, you know, Reagan's foreign policy apparatus. But it all kind of falls apart by the later Reagan years. First of all, those people leave the administration. Well, Kirkpatrick is basically fired. Abrams ends up enmeshed in scandal over Iran-Contra. But also, you know, I mean, Norman Podhoretz as a unabashed Cold War, I guess you could say Cold War liberal turned neoconservative and hawk, for him that meant ending détente, which remember was a Republican program. It was Henry Kissinger in the 70s. That's who these guys were targeting as much as George McGovern. They hated Kissinger. And they couldn't get with like the Ford administration for that reason. What they really wanted was America to just be fighting a hot version of the Cold War all the time. Podhoretz convinced himself by the late 70s that the Soviet Union was like this close to conquering the entire world. And as he and others at commentary put it, Finlandizing the United States, which is to say turning it into a kind of like weak, neutral, you know, passive state surrounded by Soviet empire.
And gay, and very gay.
Also very gay. I mean, there was there were a lot of also, you know, overrun with black urban crime. I mean, were a lot of different insanities at work here. But I want to focus on the foreign policy one, because as you get into the Reagan era, Reagan, of course, runs on, we're going to end detente, we're going to put missiles in Europe again, we're going to, you know, ramp up the Cold War, we're going to intervene in all these Central American countries, which Elliot Abrams is the point man on, and is responsible for a huge amount of atrocities, war crimes, you know, arguably genocides. But as that's going on, you know, by the second term, Reagan is actually shifting toward the realist camp, and the neocons are getting shut out. And this creates this hilarious spectacle where all through Reagan's second term, commentary and Norman Podhoretz is sort of ranting that Reagan is a weak appeaser to the terrifying new Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, who's a wolf in sheep's clothing and who's this close to conquering the world. And, you know, meanwhile, the Soviet empire is crumbling. So everything Podhoretz is saying is exactly wrong. And the Republican realist establishment that will come in with, you know, that will continue into the H.W. Bush administration is, you know, preparing for global hegemony. And of course, you know, the neocons then find themselves casting around in the 90s for a new villain. And what they finally find is, I mean, 9/11 sort of solves that for them. And I think listeners, I'm sure, are very familiar with what happens next. But it's just to say that, like, Cold War liberalism, the Cold War liberalism that gave us Scoop Jackson was kind of a coherent worldview until Vietnam ruined it. And then in the neocons, who are very much Jackson's successors, you sort of see this like decades long project to revive it, even as geopolitical circumstances keep shifting, and it never fits.
And in that sense, I mean, like I would not classify Joe Biden as a kind of neocon, but he has a certain strands or certain commonalities there. And you're right that the realists within the Republican Party, who I think are easy to forget because they basically have disappeared as a real force, with, you know, there's attempts at resurgence, but I mean, that the neocons were at odds with him. And but I would also say that the realists, I mean, Biden has never been like a realist either, because the realists, they always like looked at the Middle East and were the ones who were saying, like, you know, what are we doing here? Like, we're supporting this very unpopular state that's alienating, like, you know, the great swath of the population of this region, you know, like, and we're tying ourselves to like a project that's going to like really end in disaster. So Biden has never had the realist critique, nor has he gone to the full throttle neocon craziness of someone like Podhoretz, of like, you know, like all war all the time. He has actually kept to, I think, the classic Scoop Jackson, you know, like of the 60s and 70s, the sort of calibrated stance. Nor has he embraced the Republican Party the way that the neocons did. He has, I mean, I think a lot of what Biden is doing is a revised Scoop Jackson program, both in terms of, you know, the negative side is on foreign policy, which we can all sort of see. But actually, even the positive side of Biden's achievement is a Scoop Jackson program of, like, you know, let's rebuild manufacturing. Let's use the sort of, you know, military industrial spending to, you know, create good jobs. Let's have a more a robustly American first trade policy, which, again, is also Scoop Jackson, right? So I actually think it's an interesting thing. And I think that that program, the sort of, I mean, I would say neo-Cold War liberalism, it suffers the same, the incoherence of Joe Biden is an incoherence that one can see in earlier strands of Cold War liberalism. I think we see it even as early as Harry Truman, where, like, in Korea, Truman thought that he was carrying through the middle course, which is, on the one hand, you have, like, this madman MacArthur, who wanted, like, at one point he came up with a list of 100 Chinese cities that he wanted to drop atomic bombs on, right? And said, like, you know, we'll just start doing this and, you know, like, give them the list and, you know, and at some point they'll withdraw. And, you know, and conversely, on the other side, you had domestic critics like Walter Lippmann, who were, like, saying, like, you know, why are we, you know, investing in this, you know, part of the world that we have, like, no interest in? And so Harry Truman thought, I'm doing the calibrated middle of the road thing, you know, like enough of an intervention to, you know, hold the line in Korea, but not go the full MacArthur route. And that, I mean, like, the thing is, people forget this, but Harry Truman was very unpopular in, like, you know, 1952. That's why he didn't run again. That's why, you know, the Democrats lost and Eisenhower came in. Because, like, I think for a lot of people, like, you know, like, it should be like one side or the other. Either you, if you're in a war, you go all out or you don't get involved. And one saw the same issue of sort of a calibrated warfare in the Vietnam War. I mean, like, Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson saw themselves as following a middle-of-the-road path. They weren't, again, listening to people like George Kennan or Walter Lippmann or let alone Noam Chomsky, who were saying, like, you know, like, this has nothing to do with us. Nor were they listening to the uber hawks like Curtis LeMay and, you know, Barry Goldwater, who would have wanted, or frankly, Nixon, who, you know, did openly talk about, like, you know, let's bomb the dikes in North Korea and let, you know, let's flood Hanoi. Let's use it, you know, like, let's Nixon's madman strategy of threatening to use nuclear weapons. Like, Kennedy and Johnson thought, we're doing the middle of the road thing. We'll send in troops, military advisors, build up the regime in South Vietnam. If there are human rights excesses, we'll, like, do a critique of, you know, this and try to say we're building democracy. So have a sort of, you know, middle of the road war. And again, like, you know, like, that satisfied no one. Like, that did not satisfy the hawks, who were like, you know, like, we're in war, why aren't we going all out? Nor did it satisfy the Peace Party, who were like, you know, why are we killing so many people?
Yeah, which, by the way, is something worth noting in the context of Biden now, yeah. Because, like, you know, obviously the left is disgusted with Biden and the way he's, and I think I align with that in you know, just total horror at the moral failure of his policy and the number of innocent people that he's supported the killing of. But it's actually hilarious how, I'm darkly hilarious, how little goodwill that's bought him.
Yeah, he gets no credit from the
I mean, Netanyahu is slapping him around constantly now, not just by doing things that he's not supposed to do, but, like, attacking him directly, attacking Blinken. You know, people like Brett Stevens have gone. I mean, it's kind of their job to. But, like, you know, if you are a hardcore absolutist Israel hawk, why exactly would you vote for Joe Biden over Donald Trump? Mm-hmm. You know, Donald Trump is promising. I mean, there is a certain idiot strain of the left that wants to pretend that Trump actually would, you know, maybe not be as bad as Biden, but that's ludicrous. I mean, not only has Trump, I mean, he's occasionally lied to imply that, and if you believe that sort of thing from Trump, I mean, you know, at this point, I don't even know what to say to you. But, you know, if you look at his actual record, I mean, a lot of the catastrophe that we're seeing unfold now is actually of Trump's making. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I accuse Biden of is failing to reverse a bunch of terrible policy decisions that Trump made, and just kind of, like, entrenching them as the new status quo. But we shouldn't overlook how much worse Trump made what was already a terrible status quo U.S. policy.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, I'll just return to that point in a second, but yeah, it is exactly the case that, and I think this is really comes through in your piece, that Biden's, like, sort of attempt to, like, you know, split the difference on this satisfies no one. Like, it does not satisfy the many people in his coalition that are appalled, you know, by what Israel is doing, nor does it satisfy, like, Netanyahu or the Americans who think of themselves as pro-Israel, who want basically Trump's policy. And so Trump, Biden
though,
is kind of
like, I could actually do a slight corrective on what I wrote if I could rewrite, if I could yeah. rework that sentence a little. I think it maybe satisfies no one is right, but we should say that there may very well be a silent majority, or at least a substantial number of normie Democrats who, I don't know if they're satisfied. I don't think anyone can be happy with what's going on. Mm-hmm. But Biden may accurately reflect the incoherent yeah. worldview of frankly, a lot of liberal Zionists,
mm-hmm. A
lot of mainstream Democrats, and especially mainstream Jewish Democrats, whose basic view is we love Israel, and Israel is our best friend, and we have an unshakable bond with it. Also, we think settlements are not great, and we wish they wouldn't do that. And we don't like Netanyahu personally, in part because a lot of Israelis don't like him personally, because he's a criminal and a thug and a right-winger. And in our ideal scenario, Israel would be governed by Benny Gantz or someone who seems more civilized than Netanyahu. And maybe magically they would be only killing Hamas without killing any civilians in the process. We're not quite sure how that would happen, but it would be nice and we would feel better about ourselves. And I think Biden actually does accurately represent the views of that camp. I just think those views are unserious, incoherent, and out of touch with the reality of what Israel is and what it's doing.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, of course one could say that Biden's policy is satisfying to people who, like, have no sense of reality, but I mean, like...
But that's a lot of Americans, to be fair.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at the polling, and, like, I don't actually... Like, you know, I mean, I think in your
own... But even they might want to see Biden, let's say... Well, I hope he won't mind my naming him. I do it affectionately. But there was a funny little Twitter exchange where, like, a few weeks ago, when Biden did announce, like, it's time for the war to end and everything, Rich Yesselson, who's affiliated with Dissent and who's, you know, very critical of the war, but I think more forgiving of Biden than you or I, Rich Yesselson and someone else similarly aligned, like, were in my mentions basically saying, because I said something... I said something like Biden will satisfy no one. You can find this on my Twitter feed a few weeks ago. You know, he's managed to piss off everybody. It's something that clearly made its way into my piece. And these guys were like, you should encourage him for any incremental move in the right direction. And some other follower of mine was like involved on my side of it. And a few weeks later, and actually the night before my piece dropped, that person comes back into the same conversation and is like, you know, how's that looking, Rich? And Rich is basically like, yeah, you were right. Like, so I do think there's a certain kind of person who really believes, like, the other camp that Biden's not satisfying are, I think, people who keep wanting to see Biden draw a line, right? Like, they keep wanting to see him do the right thing here, and he keeps disappointing them because it's all just talk. So it really is incoherent.
I mean you do have that hopeful group that keeps, you know, hoping that this will work out, and, you know, like, they're very invested in Biden and the Biden project, so they're aware of, like, you know, how it's going awry, but they're hopeful that, you know, like, if the czar only knew, like, if you know, like, once the light will go off in Biden's head and he'll do it. And I actually think your piece, like, in some ways makes the case for for pessimism on this front, because that incoherence has always been there. It is not a sign of enlightenment. It's a sign of kind of like muddy thinking. And in some ways, I mean, that incoherence is necessary if you want to, you know, be a liberal and continue to support the Zionist project. Like, you have to have some kind of muddle-headed thinking that things will work out, that, you know, you have to ignore the realities of, you know, the famous facts on the ground that, like, you know, like, would point towards a much more dire and pessimistic projection of what's happening and what will happen. And you have to, you just have to, like, be invested in rhetoric, like, that this rhetoric of, you know, the two-state solution, and will hold the settlements, will criticize the settlements, that this will actually is more meaningful than policy. So
you're basically announcing that you want to be a mark, and people on both the left and the right can see it. I mean, when Biden like gave his, I think, May 31st address and was like, it's time for the war to end. And if this goes any further in Rafah, that would be unacceptable. I feel like people I know could, you know, people who are broadly against the war, I feel like I could divide them to like a camp on either side of the precise position I calibrate, my precise reaction to this. Where on the one hand, you have people like Yesilson, whose reaction is like, we should encourage him. He's finally doing the right thing. And on the other hand, there are a lot of people on the left who are basically like, I'll never forgive Genocide Joe for all the horrible things he's done. And while I think emotionally I'm more aligned with that second camp, I mean, I'll never forgive him either, and he'll go down in history for this. But actually, I would welcome him at any stage doing the right thing. My reaction was, given his actual track record, given his actual track record in the last 8 months and in his entire career, words are not enough. I am going to wait and see. Maybe there's follow through, but maybe there's not. And I do not think you can seriously say from the standpoint of 3 weeks later, there's been follow through. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, this was just another, you know, red line he was inviting Netanyahu to cross. I don't think you can say that he's taken any meaningful steps to end the war, to do real, you know, to cut off military aid. He's clearly not going to do it. It's clearly, I think, consciously or unconsciously, the point of like a speech like that is basically to reassure, you know, liberal supporters like, I hear you, and I think you have valid concerns, and I will articulate those concerns before doing absolutely nothing. It's embarrassing, and it creates a general aura of weakness around him that I think is probably offensive to just about everyone, like of any political persuasion.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. And that's what I've always been saying since the start of this, that, you know, leaving aside the morality or, you know, like even if one has zero regard for Palestinian life, the fact is that the way he's behaved of like almost total unconditional real material support for Israel combined with these kind of rhetorical hedges or, you know, critiques from time to time makes him look weak, makes him look feckless. And, you know, that is something that, you know, you, whether you're like a frothing right winger or, you know, like Noam Chomsky, like nobody wants to see that. Like nobody wants this, right?
Or a moderate liberal Zionist.
Yeah, yeah,
at some point, yeah, I mean, even though that kind of accurately represents your position, even they will, you know, they want him to draw the line somewhere, and he won't do it.
But I will also say, I mean, on the point of like, you know, well, can you ever forgive him? Like, I will just lay out my position on this, which is that I don't actually think that sort of religious language is the way I think about politics at all.
It's not the right question.
Yeah, it's not the right question.
The right question is, can we fix this? Can we get him to stop doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm increasingly convinced the answer is no, which is very depressing because Trump somehow still would be worse and still has to lose. And how I tell anyone to vote for Joe Biden when this is my assessment of him on this issue, I could certainly point to, you know, a better than I expected domestic program. Mm-hmm. And I can certainly point to how bad Trump would be on every front. But it's pretty, yeah. I mean, you shouldn't think about politics. You shouldn't think about politicians in a moralistic way. Mm-hmm. You should think about politics in a moral way.
Yeah.
But ultimately, like the fact that Joe Biden, let's say, supported the Iraq war is a damning fact about him. It's not, you know, if he did a 180, if he had a completely different approach to policy now, that would be good. And I think we discussed this a little before this call, but, you know, it's not just Israel. If you look at Biden's longer foreign policy history, it's kind of hard to figure out a coherent through line either. He opposed the Persian Gulf War, which was supposed to be, I'm not saying he was right or wrong. I'm just saying he was sort of out of step with what, you know, the direction that hawkish America was moving in 1990, 1991. he supported the Iraq War, so there he seems totally in line with the blundering American Empire.
Yeah, I know. On that, those two fronts, like of those two wars, like the first one, the Persian Gulf War, is far more defensible and far more, like, even if you disagree with that, which I do,
it was defensible in theory because Saddam Hussein was violating a country's sovereignty. Defensible in theory, frankly. Blood for oil sounds evil, but it's a coherent concept that the U.S. needs to, you know, keep energy prices a certain place. Yeah. It has a strategic logic to it. And it was defensible just in terms of diplomatic practice. Yeah. We got basically the entire world on board, including the Soviet Union, which was still technically around for a little bit longer. They signed off.
And
it was very limited in its objectives, which of course the neocons like Paul Wolfowitz, you know, criticized after the fact for. So he opposed that one. He supported the Iraq War. In the course of supporting the Iraq War, he floated a plan which was terrible and never realized, but for partitioning Iraq into essentially three semi-autonomous countries, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. So you would think from that, oh, he's this like arch-imperialist. But, you know, in the Obama administration, he was famously the guy who stood against the Afghanistan surge. And then when he became president, you know, people say the left didn't give him credit for this. It's not true. The left in general welcomed the fact that Biden actually did pull out from Afghanistan, even though many people in Washington disagreed. And even though it played out disastrously for him politically, you can give him credit for that if you think we just had to get out of there. And if you think it, you know, basically vindicates his insight in 2009 that this was hopeless, which, you know, why did we waste another decade on this? I mean, so, you know, you could say he's been right or wrong about any number of things, but like, what's the through line there? What does that add up to?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think what I would suggest, just based on your article and the conversations we had, I mean, it is largely incoherent, but if there's a through line, it is a kind of like calibrated, let's split the difference, you know, like approach. And I mean, I would actually add Ukraine to this, although I think his policy is more defensible than...
His policy in Ukraine is well, we've talked about it several times, is vastly more defensible, which is not to say there haven't been problems.
Yeah, but you kind of see the same issue. I feel like of like what is the attempt to calibrate, like, kind of and split the difference of, like, you know, supporting Ukraine, but maybe drawing a line of which weapon systems are sent there, maybe hedging on NATO membership. I think it sort of points to the difficulty of doing the kind of nuanced or middle of the road. I mean, he wants to try to hit some sort of middle of the road position. I don't think it always works. But I mean, having said that, I mean, like in Ukraine, I think much more plausible than what we're seeing in Israel. But I think it's sort of incoherence mixed with an attempt to find the middle road within an American consensus. And
I think the Middle East is particularly, I think probably when it comes to Russia or China, these kind of conventional great power relations, which is really what Cold War liberalism was built on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Containment of the Soviet Union. When it comes to that, I think your overall Cold War liberal analysis is spot on. I mean, I think he domestically and foreignly, he basically, and then in his baseline affection for Israel, he is a sort of natural disciple of Scoop Jackson. When it comes to the major policy calls regarding the Islamic world in the, you know, 40 to 50 years since Scoop Jackson died, so we'll never actually know what he personally would have done on any of these. Honestly, it's just a mess. I mean,
because the American, you know, analysis of great power relationship doesn't actually apply in the Middle East, where it is actually like a hegemonic, America is a sort of hegemonic colonial power, working with these like incredibly ugly local regimes. I mean, not just Israel, but also the Arab autocracies.
Well, to give another example, actually, and I don't know if this is necessarily hypocrisy as much as just a kind of like snapshot into like the long-term incoherence of overall U.S. policy in the Middle East. But one of the ways that Biden expressed how strongly pro-Israel he was in the early 80s, was he took the lead in opposing Reagan selling all these weapons systems to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia, you know, was an Arab country, and it was going to like reduce Israel's qualitative edge over hostile Arab regimes in the region. Since then, you know, what the guiding principle of the Biden administration under with Brett McGurk is this like full rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Now, you could say, well, okay, they have a common enemy in Iran, but that was true in the early 80s too. In fact, that's, I think, one reason why we were getting more involved with Saudi Arabia at the time was because of the, you know, aftermath of the Iranian Revolution. No, it's more like anyone who just takes a step back from personalities and specific controversies and looks at what is the overall U.S. posture in the Middle East since 1979. I mean, you could say it's oil. We just want cheap oil, and you wouldn't be entirely wrong. And you could say it's, we just love Israel and the Israel lobby is hegemonic, and you wouldn't be entirely wrong there either, though those two things aren't really, they're somewhat in tension with each other. But the sort of sprawling web of like shifting military alliances that comes out of those first two premises, good luck making sense of it, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a larger incoherence of American policy in the Middle East, which is absolutely the case, and actually points to something. I mean, in that sense as well, like, I do think Biden is a representative figure. This is not a great original creative guy, you know, like, who's making something new, like, you know, Truman and Dean Acheson, present at the creation. This is a guy who's a bit like Silly Putty, who always resembles the people around him. And I think a lot of the incoherence that you point to is a larger policy incoherence within the United States. So that it's hard to reconcile American interest, the allegiance with Israel, and even like American values in terms of human rights and democracy with anything that America's been doing in the Middle East. And it has led, you know, to like, you know, all the problems that we've been seeing for decades. So in that sense, you know, le tait, c'est moi, you know, like the incoherence. It's both the United States incoherence and Joe Biden's. I mean, I think that was probably a good note to like kind of end on. I want to thank again David Kleon for talking about his article. I'll link to it, and I'll link to some of the other articles that we mentioned in the conversation.
Yeah, this was as always a lot of fun, if kind of depressing.
Well, we got to take the good with the bad.